This is Squawk Pod. I'm CNBC producer Katie Kramer. Today on our podcast, small businesses scrambling to take advantage of the federal program that hopes to keep them afloat, and banks are trying to keep up. The voice of the $18 trillion industry, Rob Nichols of the American Bankers Association.
We talked to bankers all weekend long at small, medium, and large banks who are processing the loans, putting money out the door, critically into those hands of the small business women and men who need it so badly.
Former FDA head Dr. Scott Gottlieb on expectations for life after the worst of coronavirus with some historical perspective.
The idea that things are just going to snap back, we're going to forget about this, this is gone, that's not the case. Smallpox circulated for years, measles circulated for years, polio circulated for years, and it changed American life.
Food delivery platforms are playing a critical role in feeding and paying Americans. We'll hear from Grubhub's CEO.
Everyone right now is all hands on deck trying to help the restaurants, the drivers, everyone impacted through this this economic and healthcare crisis.
And faith during the coronavirus crisis. Father Jim Martin joins us.
We can see God's love and the way that doctors and nurses and healthcare workers are kind of putting their bodies on the line for people. It's very, to see that generosity is one way of God loving us.
It's Monday, April 6th, 2020. Squawk Pod begins right now.
Good morning. I'm Becky Quick, along with Andrew Ross Sorkin and Joe Kernan.
First up on today's podcast, the coronavirus pandemic. We might be seeing some light at the end of the tunnel. Spain's daily death toll has declined for the third day in a row, and Germany is drawing up plans to end its lockdown. Here in the United States, the Trump administration voiced a note of cautious optimism over the weekend. This is Vice President Mike Pence, the head of the White House Coronavirus Task Force.
We are beginning to see the glimmers of progress. The experts will tell me not to jump to any conclusions, and I'm not. But like your president, I'm an optimistic person, and I'm hopeful. And the truth is, we're starting to see cases, and most importantly, losses and hospitalizations begin to stabilize.
Here's Andrew kicking off with Dr. Scott Gottlieb, former head of the FDA, on a headline that really struck a chord Sunday. A tiger at the Bronx Zoo has tested positive for COVID-19.
I don't know if you have pets or you've been watching Tiger King on Netflix these days, doctor, but should we be concerned about pets before we get into the rest of it?
Look, there's really little evidence that this virus infects animals. There's some anecdotal reports here and there of animals getting infected. You know, it's possible that if an animal is in very close contact to a human, ultimately the virus can get transferred in those kinds of settings. But the sort of one-off anecdotal types of episodes probably isn't an indication that there's widespread transfer. For example, we know that there are diseases where if humans are in very close contact to animals, they can get the animal infections, but it takes a very big inoculant. You have to get a big dose of the virus from the animal in order to get it, because typically the virus itself wouldn't be contagious to a human. So it could probably work both ways.
Well, I'll tell you, watching Joe Exotic on Tiger King with those tigers, playing with the tigers, they're very close. But I do want to talk to you about the more serious issues of the numbers and just how terrible a week we are expecting. But also what seems like, at least from the administration, and maybe you can weigh in on this, a glimmer of hope about where we may be going with this curve here and the length and duration of all of this.
Yeah, we've been talking about this for a couple of weeks now. So the curves are improving. The model that the administration looks at, that IHME model, if you've tracked it over time, you've seen that the model itself has improved. So the number of deaths that they were modeling on that model about a week ago, the upper bound was about 240,000 deaths. Now the upper bound is 170,000 deaths. The base case is about 90,000 deaths. That's down from where it was over 100 a week ago. So as data accrues, that model starts to improve. And remember, this isn't like forecasting the weather. When you make a model and you make a forecast, you then do things to affect the outcome. So the model is constantly evolving based on the behavior that you're engaging in to try to improve the model. So I suspect when they update that model again, probably today, you're going to show some continued improvement. What's happening is that the northern states, the Pacific Northwest and New York, are improving. They're showing signs of hitting their peak probably this week. The South and the Southeast, however, are going to be heating up. So this is going to be a difficult week.
Well, let's go to the big question that I think that CEOs are trying to figure out, executives, everybody, we're all trying to figure out, is when we're going back to work and what it means to even go back to work, what that even looks like to the extent that we're, are we going back to work and it's like a time machine, it's like what life was like in February, or we're going back to work and we go back with gloves and masks on our way in and out, we go straight home, we don't go to a lunch place or a restaurant. Tell us sort of, A, what is your timeline for, quote, going back to work look like, and what does going back to work look like?
Well, I think we should ask our parents what it was like in the summertime when polio was circulating, or if we have great-grandparents who are alive, what it was like when there were smallpox outbreaks in cities or even measles. It was a drag on society. There were certain things that didn't happen. There were things that were closed. I think we're likely to see changes in society where certain things, certain activity is suppressed as long as this virus is circulating. This virus isn't going away. I think in July and August, it's going to collapse. But by collapse, I mean maybe we'll fall down to thousands of cases a day, perhaps hundreds, probably more than that, but sporadic outbreaks here and there, and then come back in the fall. This is going to become, as we've said, epidemic in the Southern Hemisphere and want to come back in the fall. And so the question is, how does life change? What activities don't come back or change? How do we change the nature of the way we do certain things until we can get to a therapeutic or a vaccine? A vaccine is 2 years away, a drug we can have by the summer or the fall, but we need to make a concerted effort to get it.
But put that in practical terms for people. You know, parents out there who have kids want to know, well, some want to know if their kids are going back to school. I think you've answered that before and you think not. Are they going to camp this summer, for example?
Well, school's out this year. Then camps are probably going to be closed. Maybe the camps will try to get a month in. I think that there's an attempt to restart school in the fall and have residential college. We're going to have to see if we can contain these outbreaks in the fall, because there's going to be outbreaks. But as soon as you have a large outbreak on a campus or in a school or in a local district, there's going to be an inclination to close the school within that district. This is unlikely to become epidemic nationally in the way it has now, but you're likely to see epicenters of spread. And when that happens, you're going to see cities get shunned, conferences and other activities curtailed in those environments where there is spread. This is going to be with us for a while, and we're going to have to learn to live with it until we can get to, again,
well, so, but that, doctor, that's the question. Do you think there will be conferences, there will be events, people will travel come this fall, they'll be getting on airplanes, or is that something you think is not going to be taking place?
I don't think anyone crowds 5,000 people into a conference room again for a long time. I think the marginal customer doesn't return to restaurants, theaters, the cruise industry, Disneyland. You know, you decide what you think the marginal customer is, but that's typically the marginal customer that gives those entities their profit margins. I think they're going to need to reassess that. I don't think people are going to be crowding onto cruise ships the same way. So can a boat go out 80% filled?
I'll make it more complicated for you. Do you think that people will travel for Thanksgiving? They'll travel to people's homes around the country as they do, or they'll go on vacation at Christmas time, given the timeline that you're now talking about? Because I'll tell you, the timeline you're talking about, I think, is a lot longer than the timeline that most Americans are thinking about, in large part based on the administration talking about this ending at the end of this month.
I think a certain percentage of the population is going to be more circumspect about crowding into tight spaces indoors. So you pick your activity. Going to a family's home for Thanksgiving isn't one of those activities I think that's going to be curtailed. Crowding into a restaurant for an adult population is. So there's certain things I think people are going to be much more circumspect about doing. Look, I think you're going to see people be more circumspect about why they get on. I will fly. I'm sure people will fly. But will you take that extra flight? Will you go on the trip that you really didn't need to take? That's what's going to change. You know, people are going to, I think the marginal activity that involves crowding into theaters, airports, small venues inside where there is spread is going to change, especially as these reports of outbreaks happen around the city, around the country. The idea that things are just going to snap back, we're going to forget about this is gone. That's not the case. This is going to be with us. I mean, remember, smallpox circulated for years, measles circulated for years, polio circulated for years before there was a vaccine, before it was vanquished, and it changed American life. Things changed. We did things differently. We're going to have to do things differently with the coronavirus circulating in the background. This is a fearsome pathogen. This is right up there with some of the most fearsome contagious diseases that we've dealt with. Things will change until we can get a vaccine to this, but an effective drug can deliver the same kind of opportunity, which is why I'm so perplexed why there's not a more deliberate effort to get it, because that we could have in the near term.
Okay. Dr. Scott Gottlieb, always enjoy talking to you. Hope to have this opportunity again.
The $350 billion payroll protection program that was launched Friday was in for a little bit of a bumpy ride for banks and the borrowers looking for relief. And Kate Rogers joins us right now. She's got more on how the process is kind of playing out as we get a little deeper into this. Kate, good morning.
Hi, Becky. Good morning. From the information that's been made available to CNBC, we understand the process would work like this. Small business owners contact the bank that they currently have a relationship with and submit their PPP application from SBA.gov. Now, new applications were released late last week, which meant that some small businesses had to resubmit to their bank. The bank then verifies the information on the application and submits that form to the SBA. The SBA then gives each application an SBA loan number from the ETRAN system. With that loan number, which is sent back to the bank, the SBA says that banks have the delegated authority to make these loans. But according to industry sources, more information is needed. Many small businesses that we've heard from say that they have not received their funds, as they say their banks are awaiting guidance from the SBA. Now, as of Sunday evening, a senior administration official said that the SBA had given out 100,000 ETRAN loan numbers for a value of more than $30 billion. But right now, it's unclear how much of that $30 billion has actually made its way to Main Street lenders. They're supposed to take the next steps with depositing loans into small business owners' accounts. We did ask for a lump sum number, rather, of actual loans that have made their way into the hands of small business owners, and that's information that we have not been able to get. We'll certainly keep you posted, but I can tell you a lot of small businesses that we're hearing from are very concerned about that $350 billion running out, because remember, this program is first come, first served. Back over to you.
Hey, real quick, just one question, because we keep hearing about it all weekend, and it looks like Bank of America has changed its policy. I'm curious what other banks you think have done the same. When the loan program first started on Friday, there were a number of banks, including Bank of America, who were not providing those loans to people who did not already have a loan with the bank. You could have had a checking account or some other kind of relationship with the bank, but they wouldn't necessarily give you the loan. Bank of America has switched. Have others as well?
Andrew, I think that's going to continue to be a case-by-case basis. We're hearing from a lot of small businesses that are working with community banks and haven't been running into those same issues. But again, a lot of the banks are saying that they're still awaiting guidance from the SBA. We asked the administration about that last night. We were told we can't comment on what the banks are looking for from the SBA here. So we don't quite have an answer here on the guidance that they may be waiting for. But I do think you're going to continue to see pushback like that, and that lenders may wind up changing their tune. Remember, there are 2,200 of them that are currently participating in the program, per the senior administration official.
All right, Kate, thank you very much. Kate Rogers. For more on the small business loans, let's bring in our guest. Rob Nichols is the president and CEO of the American Bankers Association, which is composed of all-size banks. The group is the voice of the $18 trillion banking industry. And, Rob, it's good to see you today.
Good morning, Becky.
Let's talk a little bit about what you've seen so far. On Friday, there were a lot of complaints. I saw one story that was headlined, thousands of applications, zero loans. How has that played out over the weekend, and what do you think the state of the situation is going to be today?
So clearly there was a little bit of choppiness on Friday. We acknowledge that, and I think some of that has to be the result of the fact we're standing up this massive program, the scale of which we haven't seen. You know, Kate's numbers that she just articulated were really important. Over the weekend, considerable amount of work has been done here, Becky, a considerable amount of work. We were on with the Treasury and the SBA throughout the entire weekend, surfacing issues, making sure they understand what we're trying to get fixed. They're doing a great job admitting all of the challenge here. But listen, you have 100,000 loans that the SBA has processed in essentially one business day. That's remarkable. And then $30 billion. That is essentially the amount of SBA lending that the SBA did in 2019 that they did in a day. So, yes, there was a couple of choppy issues, but I'll tell you, lots of work has been getting done. There are, as Kate articulated, 2,200 lenders in the program. As of Friday, the SBA put out the new document to allow other banks, credit unions, and fintech companies to become certified PPP participants. So that number of lenders is going to grow considerably. And I would just say this, it's in our interest. You know, banks are doing everything they can to serve their customers, clients, and communities. It's critically important. And I would note that even before this program was put on the books, the banks have been doing that for weeks. Community banks, mid-sized banks, and large globally active banks have been doing everything they can to ensure that the economic tail associated with this healthcare crisis is as minimal as we could make it. And the banks are in a strong position in terms of capital and liquidity to help right now and be part of the solution, and they're stepping up in incredible ways.
Rob, obviously, this is kind of unprecedented to try and see a program like this pulled off. I can't imagine how many complications there are, how many difficulties there are in trying to pull it together. But at the same time, talking to small business owners here this weekend, for instance, the guy who owns the salon that I go to, he owns three salons. He has applied for three different loans, two through the SBA, one through the state of New Jersey. He said the process was pretty easy getting the applications in, but his bank, because you have to go to the bank that you already use as a customer, has not quite gotten the regulations in. And so he's still waiting, says, you know, he's kind of holding in there. But we've been under lockdown for, I think, 24 days now in the state of New Jersey. So he hasn't seen any new business come in over that period of time. He's got a staff that he's concerned about, all kinds of other bills to pay. How quickly, in reality, do you think people are going to be seeing this money, and how quickly will the relief actually kick in?
I think you're going to see it happening very quickly, Becky. Of course, banks are floating this money. So when the borrower comes into the bank, the bank is floating the money, and we talk to bankers all weekend long at small, medium, and large banks who are processing the loans, putting money out the door critically into those hands of the small business women and men who, to your point, need it so badly. That's why the SBA is working with the banking sector to ramp this thing up so quickly and to get the $350 billion out the door into the hands of the small business women and men who, to your point, desperately need it. It's in our interest to get this program as quickly as we can, up and running as fast as we can. And again, you got to remember, we're just 72 hours in to a massive program. But I'll tell you, over the weekend, a lot of kinks were smoothed out, which is exciting. And I think you'll see that over the next couple of days, money getting into the hands of those small businesses.
Rob, we're out of time, so I need a quick answer. But what is the biggest concern from the banks? They are the ones fronting the money. They just want to make sure that they're going to get paid back and not get blamed for things?
Certainly there's liability provisions. We want to make sure that we're not blamed for doing exactly what the government's doing. We're also around the KYC issues. We're working on that as well. But I will say the SBA Treasury throughout the entire weekend did a very good job answering all of these questions, many of these questions, so we can get this money quickly into the marketplace. That is the goal of the banks. They're doing everything they can to help their customers and clients right now. And so, again, lots of progress is being made. We have more to do, but this program is ramping up considerably, Becky, literally as we speak.
All right, Rob, thank you for your time. Rob Nichols.
Next on Squawk Pod, Grubhub CEO Matt Maloney on supporting businesses through this crisis.
If we can help restaurants get through the next few weeks or months, depending on how bad this is, they will come back.
We'll be right back. This is Squawk Pod. Here's Andrew Ross Sorkin with news about takeout during the coronavirus shutdown.
Welcome back to Squawk Box. Grubhub announcing it will donate $30 million of its own capital to 100,000 restaurants to help them during this time of crisis. That's about $250 to each restaurant. Joining us right now to talk about it is Matt Maloney, CEO of Grubhub. Good morning to you, Matt. How much of a difference is this very moment, $250 to a restaurant, going to make?
Doesn't sound like a lot, but it's going to be a huge difference. We're looking at like a stimulus almost, because the way we're rolling it out is a consumer gets $10 if they spend $30. So our $30 million is going to transform into over $100 million of food sales to restaurants across the country. So that's a big slug when everyone's working really hard to try to put money in the hands of small businesses.
What percentage of restaurants are still online and on board right now, and what percentage are off? And do you think you can even shift that or change that? Or do you think once you're off, you're off?
We're trying really hard. So it depends on the market. What we saw is in the early COVID West Coast markets, you'd see a dramatic dip in restaurants that went off the platform, and they're now starting to come back on. You have New York, Detroit that are in the throes of the crisis right now. And so they're peaking at about 30% of the restaurants are off. But remember, you're having thousands and thousands of restaurants coming on the platform for the first time. So we're seeing about the same number in terms of net, but it's just a transition.
And what's the experience of trying to onboard or even keep your delivery people working right now?
It's incredible. I mean, you hear everyone has these crisis stories. Our teams are working around the clock. We tripled our most onboarding at month ever of restaurants. We had 15,000 restaurants go live in March, and we're probably going to do more in April. It's just an incredible intensity of need right now for restaurants. And so we're doing everything we can to help them. And with drivers, right. We launched contact-free pickup or drop-off. And we just launched last week curbside pickup for the drivers to make sure there's two layers of protection and no contact to make sure we help.
Hey, Matt, I got a bit of a tough question because I was looking online and saw some people talking about it. There were some drivers, and this is not just true of Grubhub, but across the board, who were saying, you know what, I actually don't make enough money doing this full time. I'm actually better on unemployment insurance right now, given what's taking place.
You know, there's plenty of work on Grub. I know there's lots of work on other delivery platforms as well. We have our own stimulus for our drivers. If they get impacted directly by COVID, we're paying them. I know other platforms are. And of course, the CARES Act just came through with a lot of relief for gig workers also. So I think that everyone right now is all hands on deck trying to help the restaurants, the drivers, everyone impacted through this this economic and healthcare crisis.
Right. Hey, Matt, just think a little longer term out for all of us, because I think we're all trying to understand what the expectations are. I'm curious, inside the meetings that you're having, when you look at the other side of this, and the other side may be a month or two, depending on where you think about or how you think about this, there's other people who think that this is going to be a terrible restructuring and bankruptcy situation that goes on for months and months, if not a year. Where are you on that in terms of what happens to the restaurant industry?
Wow, that's a big one. I am hoping for the best. I think that the fundamental economics of our society are still intact. I think that there is a lot of demand right now for restaurants. If we can help restaurants get through the next few weeks or months, depending on how bad this is, they will come back. They will be there for our communities. If they can't, then that's going to be a real problem. But as what we're seeing right now, once the crisis bottoms out in the market, it does growth does start to come back in that local area. But we're seeing is crises around the country in different markets at different times. And so we're trying to dynamically manage that situation on the ground.
Okay. Matt, we wish you lots of luck. Stay healthy and safe out there. We appreciate you joining us as always, and look forward to talking to you again soon.
More Squawk Pod after this. Faith during a pandemic. You're listening to Squawk Pod from CNBC. Here's Becky Quick.
The coronavirus pandemic obviously causing economic and humanitarian crisis that's being felt on an emotional level across our families and workplaces. So we're going to do something a little bit different right now and talk about the mental and spiritual impact of what we're all going through right now. Joining us right now for that is Father Jim Martin. He's a Jesuit priest, the author and editor-at-large of America Magazine. And Father Jim, thanks for being with us today. It's good talking to
My
you.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
We talk all the time about how the coronavirus, how this is a war against the coronavirus, and you also hear that there are no atheists in foxholes. Do you think that people are seeing a real resurgence in spirituality as a result?
Well, I think people are looking to spirituality for answers, but by the same token, I think it's really challenging a lot of people's religious beliefs. You know, people are asking, how can God let this happen? So I think it's a kind of both-and situation spiritually.
What do you hear from people? Are there more and more people who are seeking counsel from you?
There are. It's mainly sadness at this point in the disease. There's also a lot of panic too. And so what I try to remind people is that panic is not coming from God. You know, feelings of hope and calm and peace are. It's okay to be concerned, of course, but I think panic and terror are counterproductive.
You know, we are in Holy Week right now for Catholics and Christians, and Passover for Jews is coming up. And in this time when people probably need it most, you find that the places of worship are closed because of all of the social distancing rules that we've gone through. You've got some pretty interesting ideas and advice that you're giving people for Lent. You say instead of giving up something this year, that there's something else they can do. What is that?
Well, I think right now it's being kind. And frankly, one of the ways of being kind, in addition to doing good things for your neighbors, is to, you know, practice social distancing and stay home and not give other people the disease. I mean, I think that's one of the most generous things you can do, which is to take those precautions to prevent infecting other people.
What other advice would you give people right now who are struggling, whether that just be with the fear of what's going on out there, if they've lost their job, if they have a loved one who's sick or a loved one that they've lost because of this? What are you telling people?
Well, it depends if they're religious or not. If they're religious, it's looking for deeper meaning and remembering that God is with you, you know, through small acts of love that people show you. I think that you know, one of the things I'm telling people during Holy Week is that, you know, we can see God's love and the way that Jesus offered himself for people on Good Friday in the way that doctors and nurses and healthcare workers are kind of putting their bodies on the line for people. It's very, to see that generosity is one way of God loving us.
Father Jim, I want to thank you for your time today. We realize this is a little bit different, but we also realize people have all sorts of different questions because of what's been happening with all of this. Again, Father Jim, we appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's good talking to you.
And that's Squawk Pod for today. Thank you for listening. Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Tune in weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 a.m. Eastern. To get the smartest takes and analysis from our TV show right into your ears, subscribe to Squawk Pod wherever you get your podcasts. We'll meet you back here tomorrow.